There are, I'm not really a, I'm not any kind of a corporate watcher in terms of companies and their performance in the marketplace and all that sort of thing, but there is a company that keeps coming into our house one way or another and has a lot over the years, and so I've kind of had to pay attention to some degree to how this company's doing. And I admire this company in many ways. I don't know a lot about their interior workings, but there are certain things about their exterior workings that I kind of am impressed by. They are not only the makers and really pretty clever marketers of a durable creative toy, but they're a company that seems to understand its changing context. And that's a hard thing for anybody to do. It's a hard thing to do individually, it's a hard thing to do communally, it's a hard thing to do corporately. And these guys seem to do pretty well with this. In the earliest days of this company's existence, they didn't make what they're famous for now at all. The company is Lego. It's Lego Monday. Table, by the way. We're going to be in Lego land sort of all evening from my part. In the beginning of this company's history, they didn't make plastic anything. They actually started out as a maker of like one-off wooden toys. One of the most famous remaining artifacts from the early days of Lego's history is a pull behind, you know, like a tow wooden duck, where you just kind of pull it and it does the thing. Sarah's like, yeah, that's the duck. So that was Lego in its early incarnations. And then somebody discovered how to make an easily colored, fairly durable, easily replicated plastic brick. And everything changed for the people that are Lego. And from there, the company started to sell certain sets of bricks that could be assembled into particular toys. And you can still buy the kind of Lego that kind of got Lego started. I went shopping. I got it, Brian.
That's a double
shirt. Not right in the corner. So, when things were kind of getting going for Lego, They got famous by making what I would call a single toy. So when you bought Lego in its earliest kind of iterations of this stuff, you bought a particular Lego item. And that's what you got. In this case, a smart car and an urban hipster. Lego urban. Okay? I know. It's awesome, eh? For those of you, that could be Stephen Jobs. It's a, yeah, this might be like a memorial toy. Anyway, briefcase toting, environmentally conscious plastic guy. Hope the irony doesn't escape us all. So, this guy has the same half-life as nuclear waste. So that's sort of Lego as a classic. That's true. You can. We're kind of going to get to that part. So that's where kind of Lego gets things going. And they're doing gangbusters with that. And when you open that box up, you find a set of instructions inside. And that set of instructions tell you how to make a smart car and the little Lego guy. And that's what all the pieces inside are there for. There aren't any spare pieces, except sometimes Lego, in its wisdom, puts in a spare headlight or a spare little piece so it would easily be dropped into the rug and disappear. I have never, ever, ever brought home a Lego set, and some of them have thousands of pieces, that was missing a piece. That's kind of impressive at some, you know, not very cosmic level, but given what this stuff cost, I'd be ticked if there are any pieces missing. And then what happens is, as Lego kind of evolves its own brand and its own market strategy, they start to make larger, more complex toys. And if you open up one of the larger boxes of Lego that makes an object with more pieces, what you find inside are these little kind of subsets. They're these little perforated plastic bags. They have groupings of pieces in them. And the groupings of pieces, this is going to be awesome. the groupings of pieces, you know, I got an idea. Travis tried rolling that white cube against that door. I think we should actually roll it against this door, and then we'll have airspace in between, and I think that's going to be more helpful. So let's try that. Let's see if my theory works. Didn't make any difference, did it? Oh. Yeah, it did. All right. The soundtrack for our Lego evening. So what happens is when you get into these bigger, more complicated Lego pieces, there's these little sub-bags in there. Sub-bags of pieces that belong to certain segments of the building process. And if you're following the instructions carefully, you can kind of go to bag number one, and the pieces that you need are going to be in there, and you put that piece together and then you build the next. It's all very systematic, and it works remarkably well. It's still, even the big complex ones at this stage in Lego's life, are still, you buy this box, you get these pieces, you pull out this set of instructions, and you build this object. And that's how their entire sort of philosophy of marketing worked. We're going to sell you all the bits for an airplane, and when you take them out of the box, you're going to have an airplane while you're done. I remember a cartoon in Mad Magazine a bunch of years ago, where it was this rhyming thing, where the whole rhyme was like, put A to B and now add C, and then comes D, and they kind of did this iambic pentameter poem through the whole process, and at the end the punchline was, and you've now assembled your Sherman tank, and this guy's standing there looking at a perfect Eiffel Tower. So, you know, Lego instructions are actually a lot better than that. They tend to turn out like the thing that the box says they'll turn out. Lego still makes lots of stuff like that, but there's been this interesting evolution in Lego in the past couple of decades. They've started to sell two different types of products. And the first is what they call creator sets. They're usually bigger sets, lots of pieces, really substantial instruction books, like just massive. These things are like catalogs. I mean, they're.
Or you can subscribe to the magazine that gives you a new pattern every month.
Yeah, right? But I mean, that's a pretty serious set of step-by-steps. And so when you buy these big sets, they come with something like this. But then what Lego started to do, you got to stay with me if you're indifferent to Lego. We're going somewhere with this. They started to make these things called creator sets. So on the one side, you kind of get classic Lego branding. This is going to build you this great big airplane, right? You kind of know what you're in for. But because it's a creator set, it's 3-in-1. With the same bunch of pieces, you can not only build that, you can build all of these. Now, how awesome is that? Because what happens when you buy a set of Lego, if you're a Lego building kind of kid, is you take it out of the box, and you build the thing that came in the box, and once you've built it, then what do?
Well, you could take it apart and build it again. You still have the instructions. You could take it apart and just leave it apart. You could take it apart and lose the instructions and wish to build it again. That happens.
So that's one thing that Lego did, is they started building these 3-in-1 creator sets. And then the second thing that they did is they started to sell, kind of went full circle back to the beginning of their marketing strategy, and they started to sell loose bricks again, actual pieces. And essentially what that does is it provides access to a whole bunch of parts that are unrelated. So you can choose the parts. They're too smart to sell all the parts to all the sets. So if you want the esoteric pieces, the oddballs, the curved ones, the one-offs, the shaped wings, the whatever, the non-brick kind of parts, you kind of got to buy one of those big sets. But almost all those standard bits you can buy as bits. Now, both of those could be understood as an acknowledgement of what everyone that's ever played with Lego or been around a kid that plays with Lego already knows, which is once you're done making what the instructions say to make, you take it apart and you put all the parts in a box. And if you like Lego, well, depending on your personality, Davis has sorted all his parts by size and color into bins so he can find what he wants. Not all of the people in the house have the same personality. Some of them have personality that's more like this. And so what you do is you take it apart and you put it into a box, and then if you want something, you have to dump it out and find the part that you want. Which means that the pieces end up spread out all over whatever space that you're in. Don't, if you step on one of these suckers in the dark, in your bare feet, I don't care how righteous you are.
There's a great pattern on Pinterest to solve that problem.
You're gonna, I believe that. You're gonna swear. Anyway, so this is what happens. And then, you're looking at a completely different experience. Now, one of the things that I love about Lego is that as the company has made these kind of changes, they've more or less been tracking along with something that's going on in the culture. That's kind of intriguing. They're European, but they're very conscious of what's going on in North America. That's their biggest market. And what they've tracked along with, really broadly speaking, is the evolution in the culture of the understanding of a couple of really big ideas. And I'm going to call those ideas reality and truth. And it might seem like an odd correlation, but Lego has actually been paying attention to the different way that people think about what it means to make something that matters in the culture, to make the right thing. And they have responded to that brilliantly. So it wasn't very long ago in our culture that the idea of what was true, what was truth, was that truth was something that was singular and something that was completely knowable, and that the idea of reality essentially was either something was real or it wasn't. And those are the only options when it came to understanding what truth was and what reality was. And all of that started to move out of the center when we started to mess with the perspective that observing something changes it. When we started to, especially in science, which was interesting, which sort of specializes in this idea of the detached objective observer, when we started to notice that our observation of things changed their behavior, even particles, really, really small ones, didn't behave the same way when they were watched than when they weren't, which is not an idea I'm going to try to unpack tonight. Let's just take it that that's a layperson's summary of what's kind of unfolding in the scientific realm. And all of that leads us somewhere like this. We live these days in an age where the idea of a single instruction way, an only one way understanding of the ideas of reality and truth is long gone. The idea that truth is a single point that we're just trying to all get close to, the same single point, no longer at the center of our cultural understanding of the idea of truth at all. The idea that reality is something that's the same, whether we observe it or not, that one's losing its grip pretty thoroughly as well. Really fascinating stuff. It's intriguing to me, as a Christian person, how one of the last bastions of the way of thinking that I'm describing as a single instruction way of thinking has been Christianity. That's been kind of one of the last holdouts. More broadly, religious fundamentalism of all stripes has been one of the last holdouts of the way of thinking that says something like this. So in the religious realm, it unfolds kind of like this sentence. Belief in God comes in an idea box called religion. It comes with a set of prescribed instructions called the Bible in Christendom, and it can only be assembled in one right way. I remember a friend telling me about an experience they had in a faith community that claimed to meet people wherever they were at in their journey. And she said, you know, what I feel like is happening to me here is that I'm being told you can paint the room any color you want as long as it's blue. And there can be something to that critique, you know. There are ways in which, as religious communities, in our interest in sharing this story with people who might not be receptive to it, we can kind of do something like a bait and switch. We can say, whatever you believe is fine. Until you actually start to get serious about belief, and then you'd better believe like we believe, or you're not believing. Wherever you're at, that's all good with us. Until you start to get close to where we are, whoever the we at the core of this enterprise is, and then you got to kind of take the bag with the baggage. Then you got to kind of take the culture along with the belief. Then you have to take the theological particulars along with the communal acceptance. Then you have to take behavioral codes along with receiving love and affirmation. And that's what this friend was talking about when she said, what I'm experiencing here is that I'm being told I can paint the room any color I want as long as it's blue. I think the other thing that was going on for that person in their journey was that they wanted to have an experience of belief that was more like kind of an amorphous acceptance of anything and everything. In our Lego illustration, that's a little bit like wishing the bricks were malleable. Wishing we could take the brick and just kind of get into whatever shape we want. Or wishing that we could take any particular brick and combine it flawlessly, effortlessly, with Playmobil. With some other bricks. With those Lego lookalikes, whatever they're called, creator blocks, I don't know what they're called. Anyway.
Some of them.
Yeah, yes, to a point. And then it just doesn't work. It might be that she was wishing for something that she couldn't have. And that's a tricky intersection. It's a tricky intersection in the analogy. It's a tricky intersection in life and in community. The thing about the nature of belief in general, and Christian belief in particular, since that's our framework here, is that we can think of it in several different ways under this simile. If we're thinking of belief as being like Lego, we could think of belief as being like two bins. And the nature of belief is that either you are outside the bin, or you are inside the bin. Inside the bin, belief. Outside the bin, not belief. That's the way belief behaves. You've heard me talk about binary thinking. That's a pretty good example of a binary understanding of belief. It's either one or zero. You're either in or you're out. It's fascinating, among other things, to pay attention to people's understanding of their own spiritual journey. About 15 years ago, somebody did a large American survey and asked, among people who claimed Christian faith, and asked what percentage of them could identify the point at which they said, this is where I became a Christian believer. And about 69% of them said they could name that moment. About a decade later, They redid the same survey, and intriguingly, about 69% of the survey said they couldn't. They claimed belief, still. The whole sample claimed belief. But almost the exact opposite stat about whether they could say it started right here and right then. That's indicative of a shift away from this understanding of belief. The in the bin, out of the bin understanding of belief. I don't say that to assail that understanding, but rather to just observe the shift away from it in the culture. Another way, under this illustration, that we could think about belief is to think of it like a singular thing. Like this. It's a singular thing. It does require some assembly. And although it comes with several components, it also comes with a set of instructions. And the set of instructions is absolutely prescriptive. There is only one way to assemble smart car and eco-friendly guy. And if you don't assemble it that way, the pieces are not going to fit together. You are not going to get this. And you will have done it wrong.
What if it doesn't give the instructions in your language?
Every analogy fails. Some are smart analogy.
that's
actually a fabulous observation under this illustration.
But they're pictorial, so...
It helps that they're pictures, yes. And they do. The big ones come in several languages. They've kind of taken that one on. But what if? How might one assemble this thing if it comes with a cultural barrier, with a language barrier, with a comprehension barrier? But it's another way to think about belief, is that it's like a single-use, single-object kind of thing. It comes with those kind of instructions and that kind of assembly.
Can you distinguish that from, you know, like binary thinking?
Yes. This requires some assembly. So you can have the pieces of belief and not have them together. It's not like either those pieces are belief or those pieces are not belief. Bit of a nuance. But this whole thing requires some of that. Another way to think about the nature of belief is that it comes like a thing that requires some assembly, but it can be assembled in more than one way. It might have more than one shape and appearance, but it still has to be assembled according to prescriptive instructions. And if you don't follow the directions very carefully and very thoroughly, you still don't get belief. You still don't get faith. You get something else, but it's not the thing. Yet another way to think about what it means to believe is that belief is something that comes with pieces that can be assembled in a number of ways. They can be assembled according to the work someone else has done about the possibilities of their assembly. I don't know if you've ever put together a complicated piece of Lego, but the engineering in these things is awesome. It is actually genuinely inspiring. It's utterly remarkable stuff. And any one of my kids that said to me, you know what, I want to do whatever kind of training I need to do to become a Lego engineer, I'd be cheering them on and just pointing them to the RESP tank. You can have whatever's in there, kid. Go for it. These people are smart. The people who put this stuff together are accomplished people. It's very impressive. But this way of thinking about what it means to assemble belief under this kind of little illustration here is that even though we're inspired by the brilliant work that's been done to illustrate the possibilities, to say here's some things you could make with this bin full of pieces, we also understand under this idea that in fact what we have in front of us is not a group of prescribed pieces that can only make certain previously directed things, but a group of pieces that can be assembled based on not a prescription, but on imagination. On what we think of when we look at this heap of pieces. Now, if you're a person who's kind of attracts these ideas, then there's probably some part of you that's saying, yeah, but all that's left at the end of that is whatever you want to make out of a bunch of pieces is fine. That's a curious shape of belief. Sounds a lot like shapes I've encountered, but what's recognizable about that shape? What's definable about that shape? What helps it stand for or against or in the midst of, in dialogue, anything? It's a good question. It's a bit of a logical fallacy to go down that path. And lots of us have been trained under this particular fallacy, but it needs to be challenged. And this is the simplest way that I can think of to challenge it. And this is not my language, but I love this phrase. Walter Brueggemann, super thoughtful theologian, guy you've heard me refer to before, somebody that I have a lot of admiration for as a thinker in this realm, would encourage those he's speaking to when he writes about this idea to think of the pieces that we work with when we assemble faith. as discrete pieces that are there to fund the imagination as we assemble faith. And that phrase, fund the imagination, has just stuck in my, kind of the burr in my mental socks. Because that is a fantastic idea. We've talked a lot here about the necessity of imagination in the life of faith. And that's not a theme that's going anywhere for me soon, so if you find it tiresome, you just have to have a little switch for that noise that you flip when it goes, whenever I hit it, and then you switch it back on for the next idea. Because it's not going away. And the reason that I think it's so important is because when we come to all of these pieces in the assembling of faith, we are inspired by their discrete particular nature, their color, their shape, their possibilities. We are informed by their nature. We are also limited by their nature. We cannot combine anything with anything and have it actually work. It doesn't work. We can't make a curved object out of one of these rectangular Lego bricks. It won't do it. It won't survive. If we try to do things like apply heat to it, we can malform it. We'll end up with something that doesn't connect to the other things. And so there are limitations. But within the constraints of those limitations, having a pile of discrete, identifiable, inspiring pieces from which to build the thing that is belief, that is faith, is full of millions of possibilities without ever violating the truth of the discrete particular nature of the pieces. And that's where that argument falls apart, that it just means you can make anything out of anything. In the realm of belief or in the realm of Lego, you can't. It doesn't actually work. Yes, Carol.
Comment, but it's not about like strictly how the metaphor works, but actually I think it does work in this area. But does it make sense for it to be disconcerting to find that you maybe build something and then there's just three pieces left over that have no way to fit into the picture?
Yeah.
Like even if you feel open to creating whatever you want, if there's these pieces that you still think are crucial but they don't fit in the picture, what does that...
What does that say?
What does that mean?
What have I built? Yeah, that's an excellent question. Anybody had an experience that they would say that that illustration touches on? It's like, man, this is working fine. Oh, shoot. Didn't deal with that.
Studying Genesis.
Sure.
The creation stories.
Yeah.
In my Bible college here, just like my head kind of split open and a flower popped out because I just couldn't figure out why. Yeah.
Or whatever the issue is. Yeah. And we often have this experience when we encounter something in the unfolding story of our life that we haven't encountered before. We have an experience, we encounter an idea, we encounter an event in our life. Lots of times it's things that really assail us that bring us to this kind of crisis. We face a tragedy of some sort. We become more aware of the broader, deeper suffering in the world, and we wrestle with what that means vis-a-vis our relative wealth and comfort, whatever. Huge range of possibilities here, where we just get hung up, and we just go, you know, this thing that I built out of these pieces, looks like there's some that got left to the side, or some that don't seem to fit into this thing. In this metaphor, in this illustration, what are the options when we have that experience? Pull it all apart, yeah. And that is a disconcerting experience. Different illustration that's really stuck with me over the years in my own journey is that when I've encountered the sort of things that have created crisis of belief for me, and I've had to disassemble something to reassemble it, for me the metaphor has always been weaving, not Lego. And there's some things I like about this illustration, but it's so... the pieces are not that artful in and of themselves in some ways in the Lego world. They're actually pretty... rigid and metric, you know. Weaving has always seemed to me like a more artful metaphor for this. But it's also messier because when I've had these kind of crises of faith in my own life,
what I realize I have to do is I have to reweave this tapestry that's a story. To me, it's a tapestry. It's a medieval picture in my imagination of this huge, you know, rug on the wall that tells this great big narrative. And when I look at the narrative, I kind of go, oh, that story informs the way I experience the world, and that helps me make sense of things and helps me understand and believe and all of this. And then I encounter something, and it's just not on the rug. It's like, it's over there someplace. It's not part of the story. And I kind of go, okay. And it's an immutable experience sometimes. I just crash into some of these things in my journey and go, I have to deal with that. I can't not. What does that mean? It means I have to unweave the whole damn rug.
And if it's real wool, it's a bitch to get apart.
Yeah, and not only that, so what do you end up with? Even if I've never had this experience. This is just a metaphor for me.
No, wool fibers stick together.
Right, they actually interlock.
Yeah.
Right, to me, yes. Okay, I would think
it
would
be. There's no other way to describe it.
And so there's a real tearing in that, right? Yeah. And if you do succeed, you end up with a pile of thread in the middle of the room. All the pieces are there. All the stuff that you disassembled is there. But trying to put it back together, trying to actually make it back into tapestry again. Whoa. And so sometimes we just don't bother. Sometimes it's just like, oh, you know what? Whatever that thing is over there, I'm just gonna say that's not fair. La 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 la. You know, I'm a believer. Go away. And we're just not gonna deal with it. And you maybe you've had conversations like this with yourself. Maybe you've had them with somebody else where you say, "What about this?" And you challenge something, or somebody says that to you, and you say, "Well, this is what I believe, and that's what I believe, and that settles it." Good. love your logic. La 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 la. Right. That's what that is. That's just us refusing to deal with the challenge. Refusing to face the relative agony of tearing the whole thing down and looking at the discrete pieces to go again and going, with this taken into account, what does it look like to assemble faith? And how do we do it, hopefully, knowing that the odds are way better than fair, that we're going to have to do it again? That we're not done. Tyrion, in our house, Tyrion is the Lego master. Tyrion is the guy, this is not his bin, this is just a random bin. He's got like, I don't know, three bins like this. He can dump them, he can think for a couple of days, and then he goes in his room, and we've got his room set up, so it's mostly blank floor, because it's for this. He goes in his room, he closes the door, he puts on a story, that he's just to listen to, an audio story, and he'll be in there, like for days, come out to eat. And you go in, and out of this heap, like this, of Lego, he will have made something that is like 5 feet tall and 4 feet by 4 feet, and it has electric motors driving trapdoors that are triggered by light sensors, and like Lego makes all this stuff, right? He will have just made some kind of absolutely astonishing multi-layered thing that you can't even see the inner workings of, but that he saw in his head and then just built it up. And that's just part of his way of seeing the world and making something of it. It's pretty impressive to me. I could never do that. So I'm always kind of in awe. When he's done, and he's shown it to all the people that matter, and we have said, wow, and he's shown us its intricacies, you know what he does? He takes it all apart. And he may have put a couple of weeks, a month into this. He tears it all down, throws it all back in the bin, and he's not sad. You know why? Because he's going to do it all again. And the joy is in making that thing. His imagination is funded by those bins full of Lego. And the possibilities in his mind are endless and intriguing and powerfully motivating. This is not an act of despair to tear this thing down to its foundations. It's an act of future possibility. It's not an act of giving up. It's an act of what could come from this. He believes that he'll make something even better. Whatever better means in his imagination. Something grander, something more intricate, something more deeply challenging, something more meaningful, something more creative, something more interesting even. And so he's not distressed by tearing it right down to a pile of loose bricks again. He still has all the bricks. He still has all the discrete pieces. He still has all the possibilities. All right, that's a lot of Lego stuff. Paul is writing to the church
in Galatia. And he's writing to them about this. He didn't have Lego to work with, poor Paul. But he's writing to them. They have been sold, as a community, a box of single-use Lego with a prescribed set of instructions by a group of people that Paul calls agitators. We'll get to what else he says about them. It's pretty entertaining. But these people have been trying to convince the Galatian community that they need, in order to have belief that honors God, they need to believe a very particular way. And that particularity in this instance has to do with the ancient Hebrew way of belief. It involves the Hebrew law. It involves the actual physical act of circumcision as part of an expression of that law. And they're saying, if you don't believe like this, if you don't build your faith according to this set of directions, right down to going under the knife, you do not believe. And by the time we get to the end of the book of Galatians, Paul is mad about this. He's just audibly pissed about it. Which is why basically he says at one point in Galatians chapter 5, as for those people that are agitating about this, I wish their hand would slip when they're working with a knife, and they would, in a nice, really polite translation, they would just emasculate themselves and finish the job. Go ahead, put it into vernacular. It's funny. I mean, you know, he's not a happy guy. And he gets pretty graphic about it. But listen to this. In contrast to that, Paul says, in contrast to saying there's only one way to build this thing and you're bound by it, this is what he says. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and don't let yourself be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. This prescription for how to believe, and he'll contrast it with something very meaningful, and we'll get to that in a moment. This prescriptive way of belief that says there's only one path to honoring God and having faith, it's actually slavery. It's actually a way of bondage, not a way of freedom. Don't do it. And then he goes on to say this. He says, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. And then that's where he kind of goes off on his rant about who knocked you off track when you were doing so well. I wish that they would go the whole way and emasculate themselves. And then he says this, and this is the contrast, and this is where my illustration fails utterly, where it just plain won't do, okay? Because this is where Paul moves us out of the realm of what we can illustrate with a physical object because of its limitations and into the realm of spiritual reality. This is what he says. You, my brothers, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command, love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. I'm going to be unkind to another company in their absence. He's basically saying, if the pieces, the discrete pieces of faith, which he goes on to describe, and which we'll touch on in a moment, if there are pieces from which we can assemble faith, we can't mix them with what he calls the flesh or the law, the sinful nature. We can't mix Lego and Playmobil when we're assembling faith. The thing we end up with assembling is not the thing that the discrete pieces fund the imagination of. It's something else. The discrete pieces from which we assemble faith, and listen to how poetic these are, you guys. How much they're not like Lego bricks. And yet how defined they are at the same time. Only poetry really does this well. These are the discrete pieces from which we assemble faith, according to Paul writing to the Galatian church. The pieces from which we assemble faith are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And this is a fine piece of writing. Against such things, there is no law. What's the law? The law is the thing that binds us up into a single understanding and says, unless you operate precisely like this, you do not have belief. Paul goes quite a far out of his way to say the law won't save you. The law will condemn you. All the law will do is tell you you can't make the grade. All the law will help you understand is that you are inadequate for belief. Instead of that, instead of facing down the barrel of if I assemble this thing wrong, I'm screwed, Paul says, think about it this way. These are the pieces from which we assemble faith. Live deeply into them and start assembling. Paul knows. He's lived long enough. He's wise enough to know that whatever we assemble out of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control is going to be challenged by the things we face in life. We are going to come to circumstances where the thing we assemble is faced by some challenge, and when we try to actually live into that challenge with the thing that we've assembled, it just plain fails. And we find ourselves not behaving anything like that. What are those pieces doing over there? What got left out? How come this failed? How come this thing that I've built that I call my belief or my faith just won't haul this freight? Does it mean that I have the wrong discrete pieces? Does it mean that the thing that I assembled previously that carried me this far is now invalid? No, it doesn't. See, that kind of thinking belongs entirely to the understanding that I only have one chance to assemble it, I have to assemble it right, and if I don't assemble it right, whatever I have is not faith. Wrong paradigm. What Paul says is what you have to engage with are these components. What you're called to do, what I'm called to do, is creatively, funded by those truths, to assemble faith. This is where the Spirit kind of gets in there and messes with all kinds of things. In the interior's process, it's his muse, it's creativity, it's imagination. In the spiritual life, our sacred text calls that same realm the realm of the Spirit, where God moves and pokes and prods and massages and inspires and tosses us off cliffs so we have to think about things while we're in the air. You know, that's kind of that realm. And in that realm, we're still working with the same discrete pieces. But our imagination is stirred differently by them under different circumstances. And so when we encounter a circumstance where the thing that we've made that we call our way of belief lets us down, and it happens to pretty much, I think, everybody at some point, then what we get to do, like Tyrion when he's all done his masterpiece and he stood back and it's been admired, it's a good thing, it's a lovely thing, it's an awesome thing. We can still stand back and go, "Huh, I'm taking that down to the foundations. I still got all the discrete pieces. My imagination is still richly funded by these holy elements of the thing that can be built that is called faith. The things that God has given me to build with. And now I'm going to build it again. And it's going to look different. And all things being well, it's going to be better. But I'm not done. Because I'm going to crash head on into something that tears it down again or says, that's not going to handle this. And I'll know that that's true. And I'll be sitting there looking at my last awesome creation of belief and going, huh, wow. If I thought that was the end of the process, I'm now in despair. If I thought that was a stage in the journey and I get to tear it down and build it back up again and it's going to grow, evolve, improve, then I just have a chance to re-engage with building faith. With putting together the creative thing that's called faith from the discrete pieces that are the fruit of the Spirit. They're just such different pictures. In one of them, any failure is an utter failure. In the other one, failure is an opportunity to creatively re-understand what the thing is that is my belief, my faith in God, my experience of the character, nature, and work of God. All of those things. I don't have to throw my faith out because my current shape of it didn't haul its freight in a certain situation. Not even close. It's an opportunity to creatively re-engage in the assembly of faith. We're not going to take this on today, but of course, one of the implications of what I've been saying is that it means that the Bible is not a big book of instructions for a single fixed model of belief, but it's more like a holy resource book. It's more like a holy fund for our imagination as we try to assemble faith day by day and moment by moment with the pieces that Paul calls the fruit of the Spirit. And if we grew up thinking about it primarily as a legal document or a propositional document or a single set of instructions for a single application kind of document, that's a very disconcerting thought. And it could feel like it assails the authority, the holiness, the inspired nature, the whatever some of the key points are in that argument of the text. And it doesn't at all. But it is a very different way to come to those things. That said, and Paul makes this point, he just wants us to move on from it, but he never says that all the people who lived under the law before God did not have belief. He never says that that system given to those people, to the ancient Hebrews, by God, is invalid. He just says, under Jesus, we're going on from there. That's done, complete, no longer necessary. We're on to the next thing. And here's how the next thing works. I'm going to go, the Spirit's going to come, the Spirit's going to bring these pieces to you, and you are going to put them together. By the Spirit, before God, in and together with community, in ways that reflect the shape of God in the world, that reflect the way Jesus would walk if he was walking here now. And when you find out that you haven't quite got it sorted enough to cover off whatever you ran into, don't panic. Just tear it down. You'll still have all the discrete pieces because those pieces actually are given by God. They're not ours to throw away or to take on. They're just there. We can accept them and work with them, or we can just go, no, I'm not going to work with that. But they're there. So they're not going to go away. And then we start to reassemble the thing called faith. And the possibilities are endless. And that's a pretty awesome thought. That's all I'm going to say about that, because I think, honestly, it's time for us to get our band. Which is not a judgment on the band in the next room, although I do have an opinion.